This session is built on the programme as a round table. It certainly doesn't look very round to me, and I can't see many tables, but let's make the best of the arrangements that we've got. The intention is very much to make this a discussion and not a series of presentations and kind of questions and answers as we might have in a normal session. So we'll do our best with this kind of not very helpful setup to try to achieve that. So let's go on that basis. My name's John Tibbett. I'm now spending most of my time working with Pascal International Observatory, which has amongst its interests a big program running looking at the engagement of higher education in their regional situations. And so it's a great pleasure for me to be involved in this discussion here, where we can, I think, have the chance to pick up on some of Keith's suggestions in the previous session, and indeed to do some of the things he urged us to do, which I hope we'll manage to do, is to be brave and to kind of think the unthinkable and see where we can get in looking to try to explore some of the implications for the delivery and the participation in communities against the context of the big society as Keith was describing it. It is perhaps interesting to be talking about this today when, as he was saying, the localism bill is, I think, going through the House of Lords at the moment. We had the white paper on funding of higher education in England yesterday, which is obviously has all sorts of implications which are not altogether clear yet, but will undoubtedly have big implications for the way institutions are able to relate to their communities. And of course, we are expecting Scotland's equivalent announcement of its funding arrangements, which we expect to be very different from those down south any day now. So we have a variety of unknowns, if you like, against which we can pursue this discussion. But in any case, let's see where we get. I don't want to take up much time, really, with this. We want to run it in as participative a way as we can. We intend that each of our speakers will speak for a short time, and we'll try to limit ourselves to 5 or 6 minutes each. And that should leave plenty of time for discussion, which I hope will be on points that the speakers have raised, but will also be on issues that you yourselves generate, and between yourselves as much as it is between us and you in the panel. I don't really want to say any more, because I think Keith set out very well the background to so-called big society developments. What we're talking about is undoubtedly, potentially, a huge social innovation in that it is an attempt by appropriate means or with adequate resources or inadequate resources, whatever, to produce quite a profound shift in the exercise of power and responsibility from central and local government towards local communities. And clearly, universities and community development staff within the universities and their students as they go out from universities have a real role to play in that. So we can explore some of these professional issues there, and that's certainly part of what our panel will be putting forward. I think we also want to take into account some of the changes, if you like, in the way that communities themselves are interacting, and the way that some of the media are changing the way they approach some of these issues, and the implications that those kind of changes have both for the way higher education presents itself, but also the way community development practice can develop with and alongside these kind of changes amongst not just the social media, but how national media organizations as well are altering their approach to some of these quite local issues. And so we also have speakers on the panel very much involved with some of these changes in the Scottish context. I'll let the speakers introduce themselves rather than me trying to do it and get it wrong. So can I pass first of all to Alistair Tibbett here, who is from Scottish Television. We're very pleased he's been able to make the time to come and to explain something about kind of things that they are developing, which are, I think, very directly relevant to some of the issues that we've been talking about already and hopefully will pursue as we go on. Alison.
Hi, everybody. I have to say, and I should also say thanks, Dad, because this is the first time I've been on a professional panel with my dad as the chair, so it's a strange experience for me. yes, I'm here today because I work for STV, and if you've travelled from further afield than Scotland, you probably would need to know that that is the national TV station, if you like. It's a private company, and we are taking a new approach to news, if you like. So my job is community editor with STV Local, and I work in Edinburgh. And what we've done is taken a national news service, if you like, and we've tried to localize it, and we've crossed it with a social network. And I suppose, the reason I was hired, actually, I'm not a journalist, is because I have a background in community engagement, and they were very interested to see how I, previously in my last job, used the internet, as it were, as a community organizing tool, I suppose. And so there's a few challenges I thought I would flag up for you, because I'm not a trained community development worker either. As you can see, I'm a big charlatan, really. I suppose I'm interested to hear your opinions on a few of the media trends which will have an impact on your practice. And I'm sure some of you are familiar with them in a sense, but when you take them as a whole, I think they present a challenge to your profession just as they present a challenge to the profession of journalism, if you like. A lot of what community development is about providing information, whether that's about, from educational materials, or whether it's about linking networks together, whether it's about sharing information about neighborhoods or government, and so on and so forth. And so obviously one of the key trends is that there's a move away from the traditional print media online. And it's not just online. The big growth areas, for example, are in mobile. So more and more people are getting their information from their mobile phone. As you can see, I'm using a mobile phone here to look at my notes, which I wrote earlier, and I'm getting them off the internet. So that's the first thing, where perhaps you might have thought it was sufficient to put an advert in the local paper or an announcement in the local paper. The circulation is going down, that's disappearing. That these days probably isn't enough. Similarly, there's a more interesting trend perhaps, which is away from big media telling people what to think, in a sense, the broadcast model, if you like, towards a model where people now almost co-produce their news. And again, I talked about how we've crossed a news site with almost like a social network where people can upload their own stories. One of the key things is, I suppose, where communities are now almost co-producing news about themselves. And co-production is a bit of a jargon word. But that's another reason that newspapers are declining in circulation, particularly local ones, is because they're not fast with the news anymore. The news cycle is much quicker. And actually, people are sharing news on local social networks about their neighborhood very informally through something like Facebook. So there's a conversation going on. And increasingly, as we look to the future, it's not even Google which is the source of news. I mean, we're obviously very used to thinking, oh, I want to know about that. I'll type it into Google and get my news. Increasingly, we're finding that people are finding their day-to-day information on recommendations from other people. We've already hit upon the idea that there are distributed networks, if you like, or other communities of interest. People's communities of interest span the globe now, whether professional networks or networks to do with sexual orientation or whatever. And people are, in STV now, we talk about this idea of multiple locals, if you like, and we're trying to work out a way for people to put together their different locals. So that's another trend I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on. And last but not least, all this presents a real challenge to the notion of experts and institutions. It's a problem for big media companies, but it's also a problem for, I would argue, the profession of community education, for example. What does the Institute of Community Education mean when a group of people can form an informal group on Facebook, post loads of pictures of what's wrong with the neighborhood on Facebook, and generate change and influence the politics of the place like that without even having a constitution? Without having a named representative, without having anything like, they may not even know each other other than on Facebook, other than because they've decided to join this group. So I would argue that there's a challenge for you guys as community educators and working in the institutions that you have to come up with a new response to those kind of issues. And at that note, I will shut up and pass over to the next person.
I'm going to stand here and use this microphone. My name is Graham McKerricker. I am a community development worker in the south side of Glasgow. I work for a church there. I'm also a postgraduate student here at the University of Glasgow studying community learning and development. I just want to briefly introduce the next four speakers and then I'll come back in a wee minute and speak at a bit more length. Thanks to Alistair and John for their inputs there. And thanks also to Keith, who's away now, for a really great introduction to the Big Society, which we're going to reflect on a bit here. I won't have to go into that in as much depth, thanks to his good introduction. The next four speakers you hear are going to really be speaking primarily as practitioners in the community development field, practitioners with a strong interest in theory and its application to our day-to-day work. We want to think a wee bit, given the current political and economic times, about hegemonic systems that we're part of, how does that feed into our work, to think about our practice within this culture of cuts that we're facing, to think about networks for practitioners and how they can exist and strengthen practitioners, and finally to look a wee bit beyond our immediate surroundings into the wider world. And we're really grateful that you're here to be part of this, and we hope that you'll be able to share your expertise and knowledge with us, and it won't just be us speaking to you. I think, as we've already heard, you know, the Big Society split opinion quite markedly. It's been hailed by the Times as a radical attempt to strengthen communities, and maybe that's partly what it is, but other groups like unions have dismissed it as the big cop-out or intellectually flawed, harsh words. Jesse Norman claims in the book The Big Society, The Anatomy of the New Politics, that the coalition government will stand or fall on this policy and its shared vision of social and economic renewal. I suppose it said that there's a thin line between vision and delusion, and we're yet to see on which side of the divide the Big Society will find its resting place. Maybe we'll get a bit more clarity on that this afternoon. Kirsten.
I'm going to talk a little bit about how we can overcome the sort of current hegemonic thinking. Currently, I work for an organisation called OnTrack, who is a wider participation organisation for helping transitions from further education into university. And I'm also a postgraduate student here at the University of Glasgow. And I've no idea where our PowerPoint's gone. Help. Okay, I'm going to have to talk about PowerPoint, I think. Is there a button you press? Escape it? Yeah, right, so we're here. We've heard a lot from Keith Popple about what community development is. I've got a short video that I'd like to show you, just to show you what people on the ground and communities actually think community development is. This is like my totally worst nightmare, by the way, folks. Is it working? No, it's not going to go. Yeah, somebody's singing dance. That's really annoying. It's okay, I'll just go on without it. It's fine, I'll just do it without it. Okay. Basically, that video was saying that community development is about working with people and organisations coming together to try and do things, make things change, make things happen. some of the big society rhetoric talks about things like that too, about people coming together, about change and stuff, about volunteerism. So what community development does have is a set of key values: equality and anti-discrimination, social justice, collective action, community empowerment, and working and learning together. Okay. So Craig and Mayo talk about, in 1995, they talk about discussion and evaluation of different experiences of combining both bottom-up and top-down approaches to community development. And they also talk about the changing context of possession and restructuring on a global scale. So very much what was being said in 1995 stands today. I think that community development is a long-term value-based process which aims to address imbalances in power and bring about change. I think the process enables people to organise and work together to identify their own needs and aspirations. And I think that if these traditional values that have been spoken about in the big society mean that equality and anti-discrimination and social justice and empowerment become token phrases rather than core values worth upholding and defending, then community development practice will suffer, and so will communities themselves. Government policy to shrink resources for programmes, projects and interventions, therefore, are not a new challenge. The current ideology has not suddenly appeared with the Conservative and the Lib Dem alliance, and even though David Cameron's made it his own personal mission. The notion that in the UK we are too reliant on the state has been a bandied about ideal for a long time. It doesn't mean that it's an acceptable ideal, and it doesn't mean it's a foregone conclusion either. Craig and Mayo also asked in 1995 how community development can resist incorporation into state strategies for minimising public responsibility and resources for economic and social development. This question has got so much resonance for what's happening today. There are thousands of viable, successful community projects across Scotland which would slot quite beautifully into Mr Cameron's vision of the big society. However, unfortunately, like the programme that I work for, many will cease to exist and shrink in capacity due to the fact that there's going to be no funding. If Cameron wants to take his vision of the big society to work, then his reliance upon volunteers being able to offer time, commitment and expertise without adequate resources is just a big ask. Community development practitioners with their values, principles, standards and links to the academic community are often vital catalysts to ensuring that when individuals want to tackle an issue, there's a level of competence and support at the beginning of a project. Community development practitioners, whether from the voluntary sector or employed by local authority, work to bring people together and offer necessary theoretical frameworks and alternative paradigms that can expand the efficacy of these groups. At a more practical level, they're just an extra pair of hands on the ground. They can help embed democratic practices, evaluation strategies and sustainability measures. They help things work. Community development practitioners are a dynamic resource which enhances the work of community groups and local organisations. They're often vital in linking communities' aspirations, successes and needs with wider global communities. As we not only live in a broken Britain, but we also live in a global village. The idea put forward by the Big Society that local communities can solve their own issues isn't news to me, but asking communities to do this without commitment from government, no financial resources and no links to a skilled workforce of practitioners, and also no links to higher education, is bewildering. If the Big Society wants local people to take charge in their own communities, then I would strongly encourage all learning organisations to open their doors to these groups. These groups require space and time to explore their issues, thus enabling people to link theories and ideas to their experiences. Higher education can nurture their abilities to interact with decision makers at all levels, which in turn empowers groups to make decisions. It would be remarkable if universities could take part in creating throughout the country groups of critical thinkers who can challenge and change things for the better. As well as supporting groups at learning level, universities could offer practical support. Basically, universities are not government, but are usually prominent leading economic actors in their communities. And so there's resources within the communities, the universities themselves, that communities could access that they might not have on the ground. What would universities get out of this? Well, they would gain by widening participation. They could research the impact of their interventions, gaining new insights into community development practice and in education itself. This opportunity could be instrumental in creating new priorities for serving the communities in which universities are situated, at the student level, the local level, the national level, and the international level. As a frontline practitioner, navigating the challenge of working within priorities set by individuals, communities, organisations, and local authorities, as well as the government, it's essential that I'm able to access a network of support and a good management system. Unfortunately, too often when speaking out about inappropriate top-down measures, I've been left frustrated by the unwillingness of organisational structures to stand behind me to challenge what is happening. I've been left on my own. Being labelled a renegade or an idealist is not helpful. To overcome hegemonic policy, standing together is a necessary way to be heard. Even difference of opinion between academics and practitioners or between different organisations can be overcome when core values and principles about how we approach our work with and within communities are returned to. So we don't see things as they are, we see things as we are. In reference to this quote, I would urge places of learning, practitioners from different backgrounds and community groups to change their perspectives from one of competing for resources and distrust to seeing untapped potential for mutual support and a scaffolding of resistance to the current hegemonic policy. I've taken this quote from Audre Lorde because in this instance, the master's tools are our tools. As I alluded to in the part of this presentation, which you couldn't see because I couldn't link the film with what the government said, the big society has embraced some of the language of community development and perhaps tried to embrace some of the ideology initially put forward by the left. It may be using our language, but perhaps it's not using our values and principles. I would suggest that we use the so far quite nebulous concepts within the big society agenda in partnership with the familiar language as a point of resistance. So take what's been said and use it against them. If there's anything unclear, we make it clear. But there's only a suggestion of a way forward, we give a description and a clear example of how a project and programme at grassroots level, when properly resourced, works. We can develop and strengthen our current practice and develop a new wave of practice that meets the challenges of working in and against the current dominant ideology. I would argue to do this, we must endeavour to create a new way of being between academics, practitioners, organisations and communities. We become the big society that Mr Cameron perhaps did not envisage. This is not the same as a universal consensus. Life is a bit complicated and we may not always see eye to eye, but during this challenging period, it is important that we stand beside each other. So in conclusion, we must work from within and challenge from outside. We must embrace the learning from our past experiences. We can be innovative in our ways of reaching out to each other and protect our core values, principles and practice. Higher education can use this time to work effectively with communities. Community development workers can work together to strengthen their support networks and create a clear and coherent voice of challenge. Hegemony, dominant ideology and accepted ideas about life in Scotland, Britain and globally are in a constant process of formation. We can make a difference to the next shift in the process.
Good afternoon. My name's Scott McNair. I'm a local community worker within a housing association. I cover four neighbourhoods that are quite deprived here in the north of Glasgow. I'm also an undergraduate here at the University of Glasgow doing a master's in community development. As Kirsten just spoke about the ideology, the concept of big society, I think, is ideologically driven. It's been seen as a smokescreen for public service cuts. But it's also been viewed with suspicion by society at large. And I feel that's an opportunity for the role of the community development worker. We're going to be more pivotal in ensuring that the most vulnerable communities in society remain supported with ever-decreasing resources. And believe you me, resources are getting really, really tight at the minute, and been told that there's more to come. So therefore, we've got to be more pragmatic in how we practice and turn the opportunity of working to the government's agendas. The government here in Scotland has got a regeneration agenda and the big society agenda, so we have to turn that about. But as Keith said earlier on, community workers have always worked within that tension. You know, we've worked with and against the state, and we've been working within a hegemonic system, but building our own counter-hegemonic practice. First, evidence from the employers involved in housing recently discussed the idea that housing associations in Scotland could lead to public service reform, and there's a paper coming out in the next few days about that. So therefore, as a community development worker within the sector, I need to be really clued up on what's happening, how to work. But moreover, as resources in the third sector become scarce, we have to practice in this more austere environment. And that brings challenges to the way we practice, and I'd like to discuss three points. My first point is the challenges of practicing within the lack of resources. For me, a major challenge is the tension between central direction and local needs, and how we practice from this tension and use it to our advantage. But as previously mentioned, we're becoming adept at this. We constantly need to find new ways of accepting the balance between we get an upward pressure for results and upward pressure for outcomes, and we get a downward pressure for results. We always want results from us, but we need to resist the sort of adrenaline rush you get when that happens, because my colleague, what he said was, we're going to do more with less logically, meaning we're going to be keeping more plates spinning with less plate spinners. Sometimes it feels like that. When one of your plates fall, you feel as if you're crashing to the ground, but it's the nature of the job. A lack of resource, I feel, though, has led to a decline in our praxis, because a lot of practitioners out there were so involved in working with vulnerable communities, we forget about our theory base, we forget about our practice. But I think it's time, really, for us to go back out, get out of the office and go back and look at new ways of working, but they're actually old ways. But what we're doing in our association is going out to cafes and meeting people. A colleague over there said about people getting excluded. What we do, we go down knocking doors. I have a theory about three cups of tea. I go and meet people for a cup of tea in their houses. I ended up putting a stone on because the old wife is always giving me a biscuit. But we go out to people and we knock on their doors and we go in. And if we know somebody's vulnerable, we go and knock on the door and go in and see them. Another tension is getting space. We need the physical and critical space where we can go and do some reflection. And I think this is where universities come in. I'm quite lucky because being in HE, I've got my fellow students and my lecturers I can bounce ideas off, but a lot of practitioners don't have that. But I think the academy needs to be more proactive and open their doors to people from outside to come and use the space. The next challenge is how we, the point I'd like to make is how we turn the challenge into opportunities for social change. I think what we need to do is reflect on the past and determine what was really successful. Really reflect on the past, because there's a lot of things out there that hindered our community development work and our community participation. So we have to really find out what that is. Lack of resources, it's mentioned a lot that we've got to be more creative and imaginative. And so what we're starting to do is sharing resources, looking at what resources other organisations got and sharing them, and making sure there's no duplication of services, greater coordination opportunities. A good point about this is it gives us a chance to meet the communities on their own ground. And that makes them less suspicious of who we are, because we talked about as being an agent of the state. If the communities know who we are, build a relationship up with them, they're less frightened to talk to us. As I say, it's getting us out of the office and into the field more. We spend a lot of time outside now, so we're away from our computers. And we still have to spend time fundraising, but we get out and we meet people. A personal gripe of mine is a lot of practitioners have forgotten the radical roots of community development, and there's some great books written about how it started and how it's going, and they also look at some old processes as being old and jaded. For example, I use a book called Training for Transformation by Hope and Timmel, and it's ideas that were based in Africa, and a lot of practitioners say, that's old hat, why do we use them? Because we've got no resources, we're back using them, and they're just great tools to work with. So I would suggest that it's a time for community development practitioners to revisit the practice and look at what's going on and use the government agendas to their own benefits. Because what I would say is government, both locally and nationally, are looking at being more efficient and their cost cutting. So I would argue that to be more efficient, you really need to critically analyse your practice so you're actually doing something right. Because as Ledward quite rightly states, doing it at the expense of thinking and action without reflection, it's uncritical. But she goes on to say that we give way to anti-intellectual times that emphasises the doing at the expense of thinking. And I know myself as a community development worker, sometimes the pressure's on and you just go on and do it. You don't think about why you're doing it, and sometimes you can fail. And Ledworth also gives us a conceptual tool to do this, stating that we need to centre a practice on the concept of critical praxis. And we need to keep drawing on, to do it properly, we need to keep drawing on theory, because as Freer states, human activity consists of action and reflection. It is a practice, and as praxis, it requires theory to illuminate it. For example, I'm just supporting a new community group, and we're developing what's called generic themes. It's never been used within my association, but it's working well. And generative words, they only describe the world the way it is, but also the signs, point directions for transformation. So it's a good starting point for communities. And then they can address, they can see the structural problems they have and build on them. So therefore, as community work practitioners, we need to support individuals and communities to identify their own generative words. I think that's a good starting point. That's going back to some old theory and to working in new ways. One of the key concepts of the big society is the use of volunteers, but it's got to be to the benefit of the volunteer, not the organisation. You've seen a lot of organisations, they put volunteers in where they could have somebody paid. We've got a big volunteering project, and we're quite lucky that we don't use it to backfill paid slots. I'll give an example of a volunteer who was isolated from the community, didn't know her neighbours. She was from a different culture. She was actually English. She didn't really get on well with her neighbours, because in some parts of Glasgow, they don't like any outsiders. But she persevered, and she attended a computer course in the local community centre, and got friends with some of the local, our neighbours. But then she attended what's called in Scotland a health issues in the community. It's a community development course. And she realised that, one, that her neighbours all had the same sort of problems and issues, so she wasn't alone. And two, she realised what was going on around her to help her. And from that, she went on to volunteer in the school and then with the local youth project. So she increased her social capital. This field says social capital is the social networks and the reciprocities that arise from them, the value of these to achieve mutual goals. She's now a member of our local school parent council, and she's keen to undertake more study. However, with the lack of resources, it's becoming harder for communities and individuals to access opportunities for development. So my final point is how the academy can support practitioners. As I just mentioned, the volunteer, she's been on a journey of personal discovery and awareness through these lifelong learning opportunities. And they're important because Phil suggests those that are involved in the community are more likely to be adult learners. But I would argue the other way, that it's also true if you're involved in the community, you're more likely to become an adult learner. But we're seeing the lack of resources is impacting on our ability to deliver any community-based learning at all. So I would urge that universities need to be more flexible in their approach to community learning and go out into the field and help support individuals and communities. And by bringing learning into the community, breaks down the barriers of people thinking they cannot attend university. I was brought up under the shadow of Glasgow University, and I never ever thought that I would come here to learn. And a lot of people in the communities think like that. And it helps break down what Freer calls situation boundaries. You know, they can meet academics in their in community centres where they feel at ease. Because one of the issues some of the community members tell me, and some of the private areas, the only time they come across some academics is when they want to do some research on them. They become a subject of the research, and they never see anybody after that. So I think that the Academy should be fully engaged with communities, taking on board the lived experience of those communities, and in turn this would help academics turn grassroots to develop grassroots theory. And to develop this theory base of myself, people like myself, the academy could offer placement opportunities within the establishment that we could come and do interns. But I'd also throw that back to academics. What I would like to see is academics doing placements out in the field so they come out and they see people's lived experience. And I think that would help build, one, closer working relationships with communities, but it'd also build closer working relationships with practitioners. You know, you could look at things like joint capacity building, joint training opportunities, accreditation, volunteer opportunities, and we could access support for developing our skills. This could initially be done by universities developing community-based networks of academics, communities and practitioners to help develop practices. So my final point is, I think in these austere times, it's important that we strengthen our practice by building a stronger link between practice and theory. And thank you very much for listening. I'd just like to pass you over to Graham, who'll talk about networks. Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Given the scale of cuts, restructuring and change in uncertainty that community workers and the third sector in general are facing, there is perhaps now more than ever a need for strong, purposeful and fruitful networks that workers can feed into and be fed by as they seek to meet ever-increasing demands with consistently decreasing resources. Time and space are required for practitioners to connect with one another and be strengthened through these connections. I'd like to just draw on my own experiences and those of colleagues within the field to just think about those support networks and how we can work towards them. We've heard about the big society a lot and the challenges that presents for community development and also some of the opportunities that are there to be seized. With 5,000 new community organisers to be trained in the country, this could be seen as a very positive thing, but there are things to be mindful of, I suppose. Where does consistency come from with 5,000 new workers spread across the whole of the UK? How are these workers supported to be radical practitioners when they are working for the system that community development seeks to challenge? Communities and local people are able to and encouraged to take on services and facilities on their own. Are these people being thrown to the wolves by local authorities and the government, or will we actually see well-supported expressions of grassroots do-it-ourselves community development? Channon and Miller, in a paper, see the desired outcome of the big society as the inner strengthening of local community life. What role do networks of practitioners play in ensuring that this is the outcome? We shouldn't underestimate the importance of networks to practitioners. In a 2010 survey carried out by Sender and colleagues, over 50% of the 200 practitioners surveyed said that they were involved in some sort of support network, and there was being part of such a support network came out as one of the best ways of finding support for practitioners. Just before we think about the good things that these networks can bring, it's wise to be open and honest about the elements of these networks that are unhelpful and unsustainable. I'm sure many of us here have experienced the difficult and draining side of networks. I carried out a small survey by email just with some colleagues who are involved in the field of community work, quite a breadth of different roles they play, and I asked what they looked for in support networks, and that inevitably got some responses about what they didn't want to see in networks. Meeting for the sake of meeting, talking shops, inefficient use of people's time, lack of reciprocity, no purpose, all of these things came out as things that should be avoided. In my work in the South Side of Glasgow, there are probably 10 or 12 different networks that I could be a part of. And I learned very quickly in the job after being to most of them that not all of them would be helpful, and some of them actually would end up being draining and negative and even isolating at times. The positive attributes that came through in that small survey that I carried out resonate with what I would look for, and I imagine most of you would have given similar answers given the opportunity. Things like relevance, shared understanding, shared practice, development of professional strength, identification and help to address weaknesses, reciprocity, open discussion, effective chairing, clear agenda, confidential support, friendship, partnership, mentoring, and the benefit outweighing the cost. We've heard about different types of community that can be about geographic interest communities, these sorts of things. We can take a bit of time to reflect on the common aspects of well-functioning communities, and we can use these to create supportive networks for practitioners, I think. The values of tolerance, reciprocity and trust, as set out by Mark Smith, are key to well-functioning communities, whatever shape they take. And we can see that these tie in well with those characteristics of support networks that practitioners find appealing. Creating an authentic community amongst practitioners is no small task and something that will take time and effort. However, I think if this can be achieved, then a network of support can have hugely positive impacts on a community and on practice. The culture of competition, so evident in community work, think neighbouring projects fighting for the same pots of money, delusions of ownership over certain types of project in areas, partnerships that are short-lived due to inequality and self-seeking partners, these could well become a thing of the past through strong networks, I think. Healthy networks should also play a key role in keeping practitioners sharp. Keeping theory at the forefront of people's practice must be a priority as we seek to work in a policy context where community development language and practice is subtly co-opted or hijacked, as Keith said. Can local networks ensure that practitioners stick close to the values and principles of community development outlined by Kirsten earlier? Local networks can be a critical space for current practitioners and new workers recruited as a result of the big society. A space of reflection, a space where praxis is nurtured. The New Economics Foundation calls these places think and do tanks. They can be a place where it's okay to be in and against. A safe space for practitioners to critically appraise the hegemonic policies and systems within which they practice. Support networks must be a place where reflective practice transcends the individual to include the collective, a group that looks in to affect how they work out. And earlier on, I think we heard that that's what FACE seeks to be, which was really encouraging for me. Linking practice and case studies to theory for the benefit of other workers can be driven locally. However, there is a role for the academy to offer support and input to networks and organisation. My experience working in and between churches shows me that there is a great deal of skill, resource and willing there, but they're often found lacking direction, having not always linked theory to practice. Opportunities are ripe for universities, colleges and other educational institutions to have a direct input to local networks. Nurturing and connecting groups and then having deliberate, purposeful input can be part of the outreach work of institutions where knowledge and experience reside as a source of great potential energy waiting to be released. I won't talk too much about online networking, but I think we need to be aware of its presence and its benefits. I would say that the same survey I mentioned earlier that Sender carried out, practitioners said they wanted to spend up to 60% of their time in face-to-face work with other practitioners or with their communities. And so support networks, whatever form they take, actual face-to-face or virtual, must be a catalyst for this, not a hindrance to it or a barrier. So if we really are entering an era of a big society where decision-making and community shaping will come from the ground, we must be aware that support of practitioners is a strong requirement. And as with other elements of the big society agenda, this will probably fall on practitioners themselves to provide this. Universities and other educational institutions have an opportunity, and might I suggest a responsibility, to play a role in this support of practitioners by engaging with existing networks, connecting local individuals and organisations, inspiring new networks, and in all of this, providing a consistent input of theory so that praxis and criticality are fostered and embedded in contemporary community development practice. Networks of support must work for those involved, and they must be much greater than the sum of their parts. Thank you. Lynette.
At this point, people usually say, can you hear me? But I'm going to say, can you see me? You definitely can see me. Good. I'll try and cut it down a wee bit because I want you to have plenty of time to discuss things, but thanks, Graeme. The bit that I want to talk about is how do we make meaningful international links abroad and how do we use international examples of good practice? In our university, they make it absolutely clear to all who work within the walls and all who study within the walls that the focus of our endeavours over the last few years, as well as our core business of research and teaching, should be internationalisation. Ivanov defines internationalisation as both a broader and a complex process of globalisation of education, and claims that the internationalisation of higher education is seen as an indispensable element of global economic, cultural and political changes that have occurred in the last 50 years. While Knight suggests the process includes integrating an international dimension into research, teaching and services function of higher education. Yet again, Muirhead suggests universities have their historical roots in specific places, nations and cultures, yet they are among the most globally connected in the world. Universities are certainly among the beneficiaries of the emerging global culture and are most certainly a significant part of the global community. When introducing our Glasgow internationalisation strategy, the Senior Vice Principal, Professor Nolan, said, as also Anne Anderson reiterated earlier, that we've got 560 years of where the university has supported the establishment and development of universities all over the world, and has also contributed in a significant way to the development of new technologies, therapies, economic change and cultural enrichment worldwide. The university has indeed much to be proud of in terms of its work abroad. In terms of research and knowledge, the mission for the University of Glasgow is to promote a culturally diverse community, enhance engagement with the university's international alumni in support of the university's strategic objectives, of whom we have many who have studied at Glasgow and work abroad or live abroad, to increase partnership working on a sustainable, mutually beneficial basis, and to work with the city and the West of Scotland region to support social, cultural and economic development through the international profile and reach of the university. Hence, it is clear to me that we are expected to create meaningful relationships with the creation of knowledge and the development of research both at home and abroad. These objectives are important as we move into this economic, political and social period of change, into what Coote has called a great transition. Most practitioners, community activists and academics are looking for ways to change the ideology of the big society into an opportunity to improve communities, not exploit them. Perhaps it's time for academics to reach out to the practitioners and share their experiences and exchange their knowledges rather than merely transferring their knowledge, thus ensuring the creation of relationships based on respect and trust, which demonstrate that all students, teachers, researchers and universities can learn from each other. The link should be between practitioners and academics both here and abroad. Ivanov again claims that all universities' international activities should be directly linked to community empowerment, and the development and capacity building must be an acknowledged contribution to regional development. He explains that the synergy between internationalisation and community engagement clearly exists in multiple dimensions, but at the moment a clear separation between community involvement and international activities discourages recognition of the contribution universities make internationally to their neighbouring communities and countries. In the case of community development in the UK, we have the opportunity to make solid links to a number of global communities of practice which share our values and approach. And one which represents the field of community development is the International Association of Community Development, another network like FACE who are interested in promoting these ideals. Two of my colleagues are currently negotiating to run our MSc in community development through the IACD, the International Association of Community Development. Another is setting up youth work and activist exchanges between Scotland and Ireland. And because of this community of practice, we are now learning from many places abroad throughout the world about principled approaches which promote self-reliance, independence, asset building and positivity. We need to continue to exploit these international relationships so that this era of small government does not turn out to be only a rationalisation of resources. These communities abroad know much more about running non-governmental organisations than we do, and they can help us to understand how to work effectively outside government systems. In the recent research funded by the Carnegie Trust around appreciating assets, O'Leary explains that the point isn't just to get community groups and individuals contracting and doing things locally. The point is to redesign services that improve well-being. She suggests that if we look around, we can find plenty of existing research and reports that can guide us. And she reminds us that even the World Bank has identified some of the obstacles that might be encountered when relating small-scale community service solutions to wider programmes. She rightly reminds us that there are literally hundreds of examples of community assets around the world. They take many forms and they've evolved in many different ways. In India, there are people's institutions where natural assets such as forests and watersheds are managed by communities. In Australia, there are social entrepreneurs investing in the purchase of community assets to build the sustainability of communities and the organisations who work in them. There are many global approaches which can show us how to work differently, such as developing sustainable livelihoods, self-reliance and indigenous self-determination movements, appreciative inquiry, liberation theology, participatory rapid appraisal, non-violence and right-based work, forum theatre and training for transformation, which Scott mentioned earlier. We can look at the examples such as, and take absolute inspiration from, for example, the unionised rag pickers of Mumbai, the women's centres in Kerala that encourage women to run their own affairs, Fatima Mansions in Dublin and Ireland, who also run the local housing association. We also have Pascal, which John mentioned earlier. I won't go into too much of that because you'll hear about Pascal later on in the conference. But the knowledge exists for all of us to access, but these networks need to have to do more work to attract not only the academics and the policymakers, but the practitioners. So if we make an effort to reach out abroad, we need to also create synergy and balance between international relationships and those with our local communities. A community strategy for the University of Glasgow would assist the development of the local global connections. Outreach work at the university must be more than widening participation. At present, it includes increasing recruitment of school students to higher education from those areas and groups where there's low participation, and providing educational support for students in the early stages of their studies to improve student retention. The university also has the recently reviewed open programme for adult learning and work-based learning courses for community development practitioners like the one that I'm involved in. Oh, it just dawned on me that I forgot to tell you who I was. So I'll just tell you now. My name's Lynette Jordan, and I used to be a community development practitioner, and then 12 years ago, I came here to Glasgow University to teach community development. Just to fill you in the details. We've also got community-based Activate courses for volunteers and activists, and we would love to share our knowledge about that and run as many as we possibly could. The university has a responsibility to take the lead as a community advisor, both locally and internationally, as well as a research agency. Bowles warns us it seems like the government will depart from the community organising model in some very fundamental ways, so we better keep an eye on that. Community organising must not lose its radical edge through incorporation into an opposing ideology, nor should we dilute the broad-based organising and power leverage approach exemplified by the community organising movement, as in America, for example. Coote also, from the New Economic Foundation, suggests what's needed is not just a transfer of power from the state to individuals and groups, but a new kind of partnership between citizens and government, especially with those who are currently disadvantaged and disempowered. Like, I'm chasing people away, so I'll tie up now. So finally, Coote says it needs a growing movement of individuals and organisations that recognise that a different world is possible. Working together to make it happen, only with a great transition on this scale can the best elements of the big society vision be realised and sustained over time. Now, we thought, just to finish off our presentation, we would leave you with some final points that came from all of our presentations. The final points were: traditional media channels are fragmented and an increasing proportion of civic life is being conducted online. This activity may not be obvious or organised in a traditional sense. That was from Alistair. Then we CD practitioners in higher education have an opportunity to work together in a new spirit of venture in tough economic and hegemonic circumstances. That was Kirsten's point. And there's an overarching need to keep a link between practice and theory. Whose point was that now? Was that Scott's point? Yes. And purposeful networks of support for practitioners at all levels are highly valued, but in danger of being poor use of time. Input from higher education could help to bring focus and direction in this new political and economic point, Graham's point. Economic era. Lessons need to be learned from the global context, and stronger links must be made in our own communities, and that was my point. And Scott's going to, these are the questions that we thought might help you to start the discussion.
First question to ponder is, how can higher education institutions and community development practitioners do to help communities to get the most benefit from the opportunities that new media brings? How can we use the values and principles of community development to make the big society a positive ideology? And how can communities, practitioners and academics work together to improve community development practice? To what extent will the support networks available to practitioners play a role in ensuring the inner strengthening of communities as the big society policy develops? And how can higher education institutions offer their resources and expertise? And finally, what else can the university do to support community activities in the future? Thank you. Over to you.
Okay, I think we've had a substantial input there. It's probably taken a little bit longer than we intended to do that, but we do have an agenda here that might serve to start discussion, but don't feel confined to that. If there are points that have come up in the various presentations where we've looked at least raised issues about the kinds of relationships, the kinds of things HE institutions might support in their communities, the kind of outreach activities they might take place, the kind of opportunities that they might offer in a lifelong learning or adult learning kind of sense, the kind of support they might offer to professional communities, the kind of research and evaluation activities that they might help to promote in and amongst communities to help them, to help work with communities to co-produce solutions to the issues that they face. And I think probably underlying a lot of this is this whole idea of kind of co-production, co-working with communities to both articulate what the issues are that communities are anxious should be addressed, and to work with communities to find appropriate responses to those, and to think differently about both how resources are accessed and used and the kind of processes that are involved in that, and indeed to influence how the municipal authorities themselves operate and their approach to communities, which could be extremely influential in both changing their own mindset, but in the way that they support the kind of emerging thinking that could result from the sort of exchanges that we have had outlined in various ways in these in our contributions this afternoon. So a huge agenda there. Who wants to kind of start us off, either on those questions or indeed issues that have bothered yourself?
Thank you all very much for your excellent presentations. Tony Hudson from the University of East London. To paraphrase someone who spoke a couple of thousand years ago, the excluded have always been with us. I was initially seduced and interested by what you were saying about these co-creation using new media. However, on reflection, I just wonder how far you think new media actually further excludes, and I'm thinking sort of in terms of the digital divide, how that further excludes communities from engaging.
Well, you're entirely right. I mean, I threw the question out there, if you like. I think if there is a role for community development workers, it's certainly tackling the digital divide, because that's a real and present problem and will continue to be. in the future. However, it's worth noting, again, looking at the trend towards mobile, that the internet doesn't necessarily mean computers or broadband. It can be as simple as a phone. And increasingly, there's more and more of those people with phones. So the barrier, in some sense, is reducing, but it will always be there. And I think there's always a role for community development within that. However, I suppose the traditional view, you know, and I'm saying this as a community activist myself, with a different hat on, if you like. You know, when I started the A Greener Leaf community website 5 years ago, it was seen as a seditious act to put the minutes of the local community council meeting online. It was sort of witchcraft. And what's this guy doing? He's crazy. And now it's almost an accepted norm. But it's still, I think a lot of people still think that the public meeting is the unit of decision making, or the way that you engage people. And that's only 20 people. And it's been interesting to see the pace of change. But for example, you know, again, 4 years ago, I would say to people, this PowerPoint presentation, stick it online and you'll triple or quadruple the number of people who see it and engage with whatever it is you're talking about and engage with the democratic process locally. So on the one hand, you're right, there are isolated people and they need to be engaged, but those isolated people are not the people who necessarily come to public meetings or necessarily engage with traditional community development practice as well, I would argue. So that's something to consider.
As to have a slight problem with the word community, for instance, I think there's a need for us maybe to redefine it, because it does, in most instances, give us the impression that a community is a homogeneous entity and it is heterogeneous. So how do we then get to reach people who most deserve our assistance or the interventions that we employ, than just be taking the community as a homogeneous entity, and by so doing then not getting to target or to employ the ameliorative avenues that can get to assist those people that we want to assist.
I'm happy to stick my tuppence worth in there. I mean, I think there's a danger with all this social media stuff, for example, that people only get their news from people that they like, and people stay inside their communities. It's actually quite easy for people to stay inside their chosen communities, if you like, and so there's a challenge, again, for community development workers, I'd argue, that they need to find a way of breaking down the barriers between communities which exist online and offline, and figuring out who needs help and who doesn't need help, and that links back to the whole digital divide stuff as well.
I think in terms of this idea that communities are homogenous, I think that we have a responsibility to actually reach out or get to the people who probably need the most support. So, you know, I think that's a priority. So you wouldn't actually be saying that you'd be trying to reach everybody in the community. You'd be trying to reach the people who you really felt needed your support the most. And that could be any kind of group at all.
Is that better? Jim Tate, University of West of England. Just to come back on that, because I want to ask a question that is in danger of being slightly offensive. So I apologize in advance. Because it seems to me that this is very highly political. Both the big society is political, but also the very notion of, and practice of community engagement has a great deal of politics built into it. Yeah. And you just mentioned that you're looking to support those who most need it, right? And I'm just wondering whether there is a danger that the particular political perspective will colour who is declared to be in need and who is declared not to be. Yeah? If you're trying to organise community activity for recovering drug users, that might be seen as, oh, very positive, yes, we'll go for that. But if it was something to do with fundamentalist Christianity or something, you might say, oh, well, they can deal with their own things. You know, we don't do that kind of thing. Perhaps that's not a very good example, but I'm just trying to get to ask, to what extent does a particular particular political agenda affect the kind of group of people that would be seen as a community that you might reach out to and engage with?
Well, I'd like to start that off by saying that I think that we do not have a neutral or non-political role, that we do have absolutely clear ideals and politics, and we are definitely not political party orientated, but we are definitely have clear ideas about who we think are the most disadvantaged. We also think, I suppose, that that you would find out first what the real issues were, and then I think you would decide whether it was detrimental to other groups within the community, and then decide whether you would still work with them or not. You would have to do your homework. You couldn't write off groups just in case there was more substance there, but I would say, you know, the usual thing, we've said it for so long, or so many years, I would have difficulty working with certain right-wing groups. You know, that does give me problems, but at the same time, I'm absolutely clear that ideologically we are not neutral.
If long-term social disadvantage had driven, say, a white underclass to engage with what you're calling certain white right-wing groups, they might be particularly deserving, particularly in need of support, and yet they have engaged with the right-wing group and will be talking to you from that perspective. So is that, I mean, that looks like a problem to me.
I would say so, yeah.
I think it's part of our role, and it's when I am started way back in community development, way back when the world was different. I think it was, I always took it as part of my role to try and widen people's perspectives and to give alternative paradigms. It was essential when I was engaging with people if I was coming up against views which were caused come out of deprivation and poverty, that people were searching for clear answers. So this is somebody else's fault, is that group over there, it's their fault. This othering from others all the time, that I was always constantly trying to challenge that. That was trying to say that there's this other way of being, that through education, through activity, through aspirational visits, through really sort of encouraging people to think bigger than linking their own experience to other bigger issues, that you can help change people's minds. Ideology, when people are insulated, is really hard to crack, but becoming part of that community and building really meaningful relationships at the start and then being able to offer alternative views was something I spent quite a lot of time doing, which is why during my presentation I'm asking higher education universities to kind of open the doors, give people from non-traditional learning backgrounds the chance to come in and explore different ways of viewing the world, get them to become critical thinkers and to stop engaging with answers that cause violence and hatred, and stop getting them to engage with answers that actually pushes forward. And that's kind of different, it's a kind of different way of thinking. But also that, that within community development, we always return to our values and principles, which are about social justice, which are about anti-discrimination, that we never lose sight of them, because either we're chasing funding or because we think that if you try and do something alternative, we're going to lose our jobs. You know, I've lost my job because I've gone against what people have been saying, but that's just the way that I decide that's a return to my own sort of values and principles. But I think it's really, really important that when we're confronted with views that actually harm us as human beings, that we find someone to challenge that and engage with that. But certainly if I was asked to support a group who held those views, I would try and challenge first. That's the way that I would like. If that's any sort of help.
And I feel this is where education is important. I'll look at my own background from a personal point of view. I come from, rather than too much detail, I come from, I used to work with an organisation which I perceive now has been extremely right-wing. We've done a lot of things that I wasn't happy with. No, I'll come out and say, I was in the military and we were very, very insular, and there was a strong ideology in there about we were always right. And it wasn't until I always had the notion that I was slightly different. It wasn't until I started coming to higher education, looking at Freirean things and been more critical of stuff, I realised, you know, I'm different than them people, and I became true, what I would say is my true self. So I look at how I've changed. But my partner, she's also a community worker. We both worked a lot with asylum seeker refugees, and one of the groups that she got together, she decided, you know, this is wrong, the way we're doing things is wrong. We're just getting all the asylum seekers in and we're talking to them, and it's causing problems in the community. So we got what we call the host community in, and one of the things they talked about was racism. And the woman this from the host community says, I get racial abuse around here. I never really thought it was the African woman or the Indian woman racially abusing her. What it turned out was that she was Welsh, and the Scots were giving her a hard time about it. So the people around the table all realised they've got the same issues, and it started breaking down in summer. She had racist views as well, and it started breaking them down. It's very, very slow, but you start breaking down things. And again, as Kirsten said, as long as you stay true to your values and principles, you can move on. So I've had to work with some people that have been slightly different. You know, some of the people we have to work with in the north, you know they're involved in drug dealing, you know they're part of the problem, but you still work with them, and you start to get them to see your way forward. And if you can make a difference to one person's life that's involved in these things, they start making a difference to other people. We're telling them, Connor, a certain individual, he's away, he's working, and he's seen that he's actually volunteering now and doing this work, he's realised. So it's about education, helping build that.
I was just thinking about an example. One of our students works in a church organisation, and they have very strong views on things around parenting, around sexuality, and they contradict some of our beliefs, you know, around community development. And you could never say that you wouldn't want to work with them, you wouldn't want to you would exclude that student from the debates or anything, but you do have to be absolutely clear about what you're saying you believe in, and challenge some of the things that maybe those who have different views are coming out with. And that's a learning process for everybody. I still find it really difficult to challenge some of those views, and how to do it with respect so that you're not damaging somebody. But I also do have clear ideas what I think is about justice.
Unless anybody else wants to come in.
Hi, can you hear me all right? I'm Brian Finson from University of Waikato, New Zealand. It's been interesting looking at this notion of the big society, which I guess has been the embracing idea that we're looking at. Doesn't seem to me to be very much different from anything before. It's just been dressed up differently, and it's really about the minimal state. It's really about focusing on individuals rather than the collective, and all those kind of things which are associated with neoliberalism. So, you know, I actually found Keith's presentation a little bit tame this afternoon, to be honest. I thought, where is the leftist analysis? Where's the Marxist analysis? And I think that in the conversation we just had, Scott, you made a comment, the radical roots have been forgotten. So far they have in this conference. you know, it's so meek, it seems to me. This last session, I think, has just been too many ideas for me to take in at one point. It's not anyone's fault, but just reflecting on that. Anyway, getting to one of my major points, it's the role of people in higher education in terms of community development. And I don't know about the rest of you here, but I work in a university, and I've got a 1.0 job with three parts to it. And it's really about a 1.5 job, and yet I hear exhortations about academics becoming more involved in community. You know, if they work 70 or 80 hours a week, they may be able to get involved in community. So I think it's a real issue for people in academia to be effective in terms of working with local communities? And if you've got some answers there, I'd like to hear about them.
Does anybody want to follow up on that, that challenge? Anybody on the panel want to? We have to leave that one hanging, and maybe that's one to talk about in the bar or the civic reception or something after. I don't know how much, we've got a little bit more time. I wanted to kind of change the tack a little bit. One of the pieces of, I think it's on Twitter somewhere, I read 6 months or so ago, that quite intrigued me, was somebody suggesting that just as probably now we've, a lot of us got used to the idea of peak oil and the fact that because oil production is getting more and more difficult and more and more expensive, it becomes, it kind of forces us to think of different ways in which we use it or don't use it. And was making a sort of analogous idea to the idea of a peak state, and was trying to make a kind of case that as quickly as well-developed welfare states have developed, they've been trying to tackle more and more specialist issues, getting more and more bogged down in bureaucracies and definitions of what constituted needs that was, could be helped and assisted in some way, or in defining responses to particular kinds of more and more, as I said, more and more specialist needs, to the point where it was almost becoming, if not dysfunctional, at least extraordinarily inefficient, and trapping people within the sort of service network that was supposed to be assisting. Elements of that obviously lying behind the, some of the analysis we've been talking about with the big society, but it kind of raises the issue, whatever political kind of spin you might want to put on it, that there is an issue about whether we have reached some sort of state like this, which in fact we actually have to start talking about changing the way we tackle social problems. Society in a sense almost has to define another kind of response if it is going to be able to sustain any central kind of realistic approach that actually delivers real assistance to the people that, that might be arguably needed. And thinking about that put me in, made me think of some of the points that were made on the way, and that is the role of community development in actually looking at and proposing and arguing for public service change. And we haven't heard much about it. We've been hearing people talking about all the frustrations and problems of dealing with cutbacks in resources. We haven't really talked much about innovation in public service delivery and the role that community development might play alongside communities in helping shape what those changes to public service delivery might be. That seems to me to be something that is very much part of the role of what community development people might do. It's also an area where all kinds of departments within universities would have a view on and a contribution to make on how these processes might work. I wonder if that is an area that, in the little bit of time we've got, we might explore with thoughts on how those particular processes might be connected up, and the kind of thinking and innovation and ideas for public service change that universities might produce, how that links with development, with wider changes in society, the sort that Alice has been talking about in the knowledge mobilisation arrangements that, that kind of move these ideas out. Is that an area of HE support for participation in, where HE actually becomes part of, if you like, the evolution of big society, whatever that turns out, whatever that actually turns out to be. Does anybody have any kind of thought or response to that kind of thinking? Don't be silent.
actually saying that I think there is a need for us, for universities to exert institutional pressure and maybe push the political sphere into gravitating from representative democracy, because it doesn't seem to serve us well, into participatory democracy, where then people are going to take decisions for themselves, where people would be empowered to come up with their own decisions, where decision-making is just going to be an activity that's undertaken by the ordinary people in the village or in the city or the town.
Does anybody have one last comment? I have been told that if we don't finish fairly soon, we'll be rocking. We ought perhaps to wind up. But if anybody has any particular burning thought they need to get out, should they do that just now? No? It's been a long session. If you take the time that we started at 2 o'clock. So, I won't attempt to try to sum up our discussion here. We've raised all kinds of issues, as Violet has been saying, and I think we all need to reflect in our different ways on some of those points that have been made. I think we will try, in fact, I've already been asked to try to kind of make some kind of note about this, so I will be trying to put some note here, which is probably going to be a listing of issues and immediate thoughts rather than come to any conclusions. So that's where we'll have to leave it just now. Can I thank you for your participation, and I hope you found this an opportunity to start at least some thinking about how we might respond to the big society agenda as it eventually manifests itself. So thank you very much indeed.